Good evening. September is Prostate Health Month. Prostate health is an issue of great importance to men, of course, but also one that tends to get sidestepped a bit, either out of fear or embarrassment. The reality is that prostate cancer kills more men than any other type of cancer except lung cancer. And on tonight's Health Matters, we're going to approach the subject head-on and hopefully answer some questions that you or a loved one might have related to prostate health and prostate cancer in particular. I'm Kermit Poling, and I'm joined this evening by radiation oncologist Dr. Sanford Katz, no stranger to Health Matters, and urologist Dr. Lauren Smith. Welcome both gentlemen. I'm glad to have you here. You can also join us via your phone call at 1-800-552-8502. You know, there seems to be a lot of confusing information about prostate cancer. I was just going online and kind of Googling information. One statistic really caught my attention, and that was, it really surprised me that two-thirds of all men eventually get cancer cells in their prostate. Is that really true?
Well, if a man lives long enough, the general feeling is that they are very likely to develop prostate cancer. Now, whether that translates into a clinically significant condition is another story. And, you know, the question is always out there, do we need to treat a prostate cancer even though we find it? And there is some debate as to whether or not we are over-treating prostate cancer. And I think, for the most part, we are. The difficulty that we have had is that we discover these prostate cancers, and to some extent, we can't tell necessarily in which cases the prostate cancer will be clinically significant. Now, we can certainly tell if a person is old and they have other competing forces of mortality, like a bad heart, or if they've had strokes and things of that sort, where they're not likely to live long enough to have symptomatic progression of their cancer. But even in those situations where somebody is otherwise relatively young and healthy, if we diagnose a prostate cancer that it seems to be virulent, then we're in a situation where we don't want to potentially undertreat a prostate cancer that could become problematic. So we generally err on the side of caution and we treat these prostate cancers. Now, we can't predict how those prostate cancers necessarily would have been behaved in every case, nor can we predict what that person's life expectancy is going to be with, you know, other than with some generalized statistics. So I think it's a fair statement to say that we do overtreat prostate cancer. And largely because we can't predict, or at least we haven't been able to predict, whom the treatment is going to truly benefit.
All right. Our number tonight, if you'd like to call with your question, is 1-800-552-8502. Again, I'm joined by radiation oncologist Sandy Katz, Dr. Sanford Katz, and urologist Dr. Lauren Smith. And as you walked into the studio, I actually handed you something that I took off of the web related to that. The University of Liverpool today released results of a study saying that two-thirds of prostate cancer patients did not require urgent treatment. And in this case, they were saying because they lacked a particular protein that seems to be associated with the most aggressive cancers. Now, I know that among the various tests for prostate cancer is a protein test. That's what the PSA is, isn't it?
Well, the PSA is a protein. It is used primarily for screening. To detect whether somebody is likely to have prostate cancer, and it's also used as a method by which we follow the progress of treatment, whether it be surgery or radiation, the PSA should decline. Now, the protein that you're referring to from the study that came out or was reported today, you know, looked at a different protein, one that's not widely utilized or that's, you know, currently in use clinically in the United States. So, you know, as we study the disease, we'll be better able to distinguish those clinically significant prostate cancers from one that are not.
I think most of us tend to think of prostate cancer as being an old man's disease, and you were saying that if we all live long enough, we're going to get it, but is that really kind of a wrong focus to have on it?
I think so. The American Urologic Association recommends screening men starting at fairly young ages, 40, if men have a family history of prostate cancer, being a primary relative, a father, a brother, even a son. I've certainly diagnosed men who are in their young or early 40s, and that can be a more significant disease than a man who's diagnosed in his 70s or 80s. So that kind of lends to the debate about when do we stop screening men. Traditionally we've kind of used 75 as an age cutoff, but I think you have to look more at the whole person, look at what their comorbidities are, you know, what other medical problems do they have, in terms of, you know, do we screen beyond 80? If a man has, you know, parents who lived into their 80s, 90s, 100s, and this is a robust gentleman, screening's probably not unreasonable. If you've got men who are in their 50s and 60s who have, you know, significant family history of cardiac disease, et cetera, sometimes we might not screen them. But I think in general, your question is exactly hitting the right point, which is we think of this as an old man's disease, but really young men need to be aware of it and need to kind of take that step on as far as screening early in life.
Now, you're saying a cutoff age in terms of screening, because the assumption is that they would not live as long as the treatment would, is that?
Exactly. You know, when I talk to patients about prostate cancer, I talk about it in terms of decades. Where do you want to be 10, 15, 20 years from now? Because in most men, prostate cancer is a slow-growing tumor. So, you know, you started off by asking the question, are we over-treating? Absolutely, we're over-treating men. The problem is I can't take 10 men with prostate cancer and point to the one or two that are going to have a bad outcome from their disease. Mm-hmm. That's where the real issue is. We're working on it. You know, there are some really smart urologists around the country that are trying to look at different markers, look at different patient profiles, Gleason scores. We can get into that later, to try to determine who will do poorly with their prostate cancer. But that's really the question: is who's not going to do well?
And I agree with Dr. Smith. And one point, Kerman, I think it's important to consider when you're looking at these studies. A lot of times these studies that argue that it's that, you know, treating prostate cancer isn't really beneficial because you know, men would have otherwise died of other things. I think one of the things to keep in mind, though, is that prostate cancer, even when diagnosed and treated, you still have a long natural history of the disease. And so somebody could suffer a recurrence of their prostate cancer, go on additional therapy, which is effective for many years, and you may be looking at, you know, 10, 15 years under therapy, even for somebody who has disease that was treated or treated again and then treated even a third time using medicine. You know, there can be an initial treatment of either surgery or radiation. There can be a secondary treatment of hormone therapy. And so it's very difficult to prove a survival benefit to for treatment of a disease that affects older men. Now, that's not to say that these men, had they not been treated, maybe they wouldn't have died of their disease, but they would have certainly gotten treatment. And sometimes the treatment for the cancer in its advanced stage is not nearly as pleasant as when the cancer is caught early. So particularly when you're talking about very advanced cancer, you're talking about either surgical castration or chemical castration, both of which has rather significant side effects, including impotence, hot flashes. We're now seeing that it causes osteoporosis. It can lead to increased fractures. It can cause diabetes, increased heart disease. So, and not to mention, of course, just general malaise and loss of strength and you know, rigor. So I think that even if in some men, the treatment of the cancer doesn't necessarily translate into an overall survival benefit, it certainly can help them to avoid an unpleasant treatment later on in life, and it can also preserve their quality of life during the time that, you know, that they have left. Also, when patients have, let's say, progression of cancer that wasn't initially detected early, it can be very painful. It can spread to their bones. They can have fractures. They can have all sorts of pain. And so treatment can prevent these things from happening. So even though there may not be a survival advantage that is very significant in the older population, I think there are other benefits to treating prostate cancer.
And it sounds like, as with most diseases, the earlier that you discover if you do have the disease, the better off you are in terms of treatment.
Right, and that's correct. And I think it's analogous to even breast cancer. I mean, if you could catch a breast cancer early and preserve a breast, even if there was no this didn't translate into an improvement in survival, I think many women would feel that preserving their breast was a desirable endpoint, even if there was not a survival advantage. And we consider that as just being obvious. But I think for men, preservation of function, and whether it be sexual or otherwise, I think is also very important.
Sure. Again, you're listening to Health Matters this evening. I'm Kermit Poling, and I'm joined by radiation oncologist Dr. Sanford Katz and urologist Dr. Lauren Smith. And we'd love to have your calls this evening, 1-800-552-8502. You can call in if you have a question for our doctors this evening. One question that came to mind, it was something, Dr. Smith, that you touched on, just referring to the genetic possibilities there? Because you said if someone has a history in their family. So
yes.
is prostate cancer generally related to family history and genetics?
Simple answer is yes. Men who have a primary relative who has prostate cancer, be it a father, a brother, or a son, they are at a higher risk for being diagnosed with the disease than men who do not have a primary relative. Now, having said that, the majority of men that are diagnosed don't have a family history. So, you know, it's confusing if you kind of look at the words, but you know, I get men all the time in clinic who they have brothers with the disease, and I'm very concerned about them having it, so we're very careful to screen appropriately, and I make sure that they understand what their risk is. But really, every man out there is at risk.
1-800-552-8502, the number to call. What about lifestyle?
Yeah, some lifestyle... lifestyle has been looked at. Diet, in particular, has been looked at, and it's thought that a diet that's high in saturated fats can contribute to the development of prostate cancer. There's some discussion of whether obesity was a risk factor. Certainly, environmental exposures with pesticide residues, various pesticides, toxins, these have all been explored.
All right.
I agree.
Okay.
Another thing that comes out in some literature is, for veterans in particular, Vietnam veterans, is the idea of Agent Orange. That's kind of a touchy issue on a lot of levels. There's not good data right now either way saying that Agent Orange is or is not specifically related to prostate cancer.
We'll come back. I'd like to touch on that in a moment. But we have our first caller for the evening. I'm sorry I don't have a name for you, but thanks for calling into Health Matters this evening. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
My name is Jay, and I'm from Joaquin, Texas.
Okay. And what is your question this evening?
Well, I've been reading about a genetic test called PCA3, and in fact, I had one run a few months ago, and also about the unreliability of PSA testing. It appears to me that PCA3 test could possibly replace both PSA and needle biopsies, and I'd appreciate your comments on that. I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thank you for your call. Gentlemen?
I think the question concerning PSA is right on mark. I can't say specifically, I can't give much comment about the PCA3 testing. I don't perform it. But PSA testing does have some inherent drawbacks. Number one, how do we define a normal versus an abnormal PSA? PSA is about 20, 25 years old as far as its utilization in the urologic community. When we were first diagnosing men with prostate cancer, PSAs would be through the roof, meaning, you know, in the hundreds potentially. That generally represents very significant or advanced disease, widespread disease. As time's gone on, we have selected out a number of those patients, meaning that we've screened enough men that most men that present with a quote-unquote elevated PSA have a much lower value now. When I have men in the clinic and they are seeing me because of an elevated PSA, what I tell them is that if we perform a biopsy, about 35 to 40% of the time I expect that biopsy to show cancer. So that really tells them that 60 to 65% of the time we're not going to diagnose cancer based on that biopsy and based on that elevated PSA. Now, you could argue that that's an unnecessary biopsy in those 6 out of 10 men. I would argue that it's probably not, even given the low morbidity of the procedure. The complication rates are very low, and it's a very well-tolerated procedure now, particularly given the fact that most everyone is performing it with a local anesthetic.
Okay, we have our, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I wanted to add in that, you know, the PSA is a tool, and like any tool, it's really how you use it. By itself, it can be very helpful, but it's probably more helpful when used in the whole clinical picture. For example, PSA reference ranges, normal ranges, change a little bit as a person ages. So when you look at the PSA, you should have an age appropriate PSA reference with which to compare it. Also, the absolute PSA number, you know, may not be that informative. However, the trend of what that PSA has done, if your PSA is a 1 and then it goes to a 2 and then it goes to a 3 all within a year, it's within the normal range, let's say, for most men. But the fact that it's rising so quickly, that's an alarm. I mean, that should set off alarms, and that should tell you something. So it's yes, it's an imperfect test, but it can be used in a framework in a bigger picture, which can improve its specificity.
All right, Donna from Natchez, Mississippi, has been holding on very patiently. Thanks so much, Donna. Do you have a question this evening?
Yes, I'd like to know, how often do they recommend watchful waiting?
And what is that exactly, gentlemen?
Watchful waiting is it's an interesting idea. Watchful waiting the way I talk to patients about it is that it's almost a non-treatment. And it's very difficult to say how often we recommend it, because it really depends on the individual patient. Traditionally, say 10, 15 years ago, watchful waiting would be something that we would offer a gentleman diagnosed with prostate cancer who was very old, had a lot of other comorbidities, really someone who we expected to die from some other disease process. That's kind of where watchful waiting came into existence. Now I say that, I think in Scandinavia, they did a lot of non-treatment, which is the same idea. And they have produced a number of studies looking at the natural history of the disease based on watchful waiting, if you will. Now what's happening is in the past 5 years or so, there's been a bit of a push to offer watchful waiting to younger patients with non-aggressive, or what we think are clinically non-aggressive tumors and lower volume tumors. That work is being looked at. There are a number of people doing studies on it, and it's interesting, because the real question is, if you have a young patient with prostate cancer who you place on watchful waiting, at what point do you need to treat him? And if you delay his treatment, do you end up with a worse outcome? And right now the answer is men who are placed on watchful waiting who are treated, or who would benefit from treatment, they're not finding any difference in outcome, which is interesting.
1-800-552-8502, the number to call with your question this evening for either Dr. Sanford Katz or urologist Dr. Lauren Smith. Of course, we're discussing prostate health and prostate cancer in particular. We do have Buzz from Leesville waiting on the phone. Buzz, thank you so much. What's your question this evening?
Yes, I'm a Vietnam veteran, had three tours over there. I was wondering, just 2 days ago I had a prostate PSA and a digital done, and the doctor told me I was asymmetric, but he found a nodule on the side, and he was concerned. Of course, I won't get my blood results for a couple of weeks, but I was wondering if any of them has any indication that Vietnam vets are more subject, that's been in around Agent Orange, or more subject to prostate cancer. Now I'll get off and listen to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's a great question. And it goes back to what I was referring to earlier. There is some debate at the Veterans Administration about whether Agent Orange is associated with prostate cancer or not. I don't know of any clear data or any clear studies that say that yes, it is, or no, it's not. Some of the older data I've seen shows about a 1.5 times risk increase, but I haven't looked at the studies, so I can't say if I think that they're flawed in their design. There may be an increased risk in men who've been exposed to Agent Orange, but other than that, I don't know of any other increased risk for prostate cancer relative to Vietnam veterans. Now, for as far as the idea of screening, you mentioned a couple points. Screening really takes on two pieces. One is the PSA test, which is the blood test which you had, which is an indicator, and it's just a tool, like Dr. Katz said. Mm-hmm. The second part is the rectal exam. Digital rectal exam is as important as the PSA test. Traditionally, we think that about 1 out of 4 men will be diagnosed with their prostate cancer because of an abnormal rectal exam, even in the face of a normal PSA. Abnormal rectal exam could be a hard gland, it could be asymmetry, like you described, it could be a nodule. Now, those things, again, don't mean that the gentleman has prostate cancer, but it means that it's something that's probably worth looking into. And again, sometimes changes in exam can be as or more important than the actual finding. So, you know, having the same finger touch the prostate, you know, a couple years in a row is probably going to do more good than just a single exam.
And it's also important to keep in mind that sometimes the PSA is not elevated, and particularly when we have very aggressive prostate cancers, high-grade prostate cancers don't necessarily produce much PSA. And I mean, it's not uncommon for me to see a patient who, in fact, had an abnormal digital rectal examination, a normal PSA, and then was found to have rather extensive prostate cancer. So the PSA is not the be-all, end-all in screening. The digital rectal exam is very important, and it's important that men have this done annually if they're going to be screened.
You're listening to Health Matters this evening. Our number, toll-free, 800-552-8502. I encourage you to call with your question this evening for our doctors. Dr. Smith, you had mentioned earlier about coming back to this Gleason scores. What exactly are those?
Gleason score is the way that we look at the cancer and the cancer cells under a microscope. So basically, when we take a biopsy, the standard biopsy now is anywhere from 10 to 12 cores. It's performed transrectally, meaning we take an ultrasound transducer, put it in the rectum, usually numb up the prostate on either side, and then take 6 cores from each side of the prostate. We then send those off to the pathologist who looks at it under a microscope, and they give us an idea of what the cells or glands look like. Essentially, Gleason has two parts. There's a part A and a part B. If you look at the cancer cells, and it's kind of hard to explain, but if you look at the cancer cells in the specimen, the majority of the cells will look a certain way, and you'll give them a number from 1 to 5. Then the second most common architecture will get the second number. So, and again, numbers 1 through 5, 1 being less aggressive, 5 being most aggressive. So your Gleason score, your combined Gleason score, is going to range anywhere from 2 to 10. Most men now are probably being diagnosed with a Gleason 6, total score Gleason 7. The higher the score, the more aggressive the tumor. And the thing that I find most important when I'm talking to patients about kind of prognosis and what does the cancer mean, that difference between Gleason component 3 and component 4. So in either, you know, the first or the second part of the total score, if they have a 3, that tends to be what we call a well-differentiated tumor. 4 tends to be much more aggressive with poorer outcomes, higher recurrence rates, things like that.
So is it a ratio between the two numbers that you're saying?
No, it's not a ratio. It's based on the way it looks, and there's a scale, and anyone who Googles Gleason score or Gleason will probably find a copy of kind of the standard scale, if you will. And when I say a scale, it kind of looks like a mountain or an anthill. And I know it sounds crazy, but if you look at it, you'll understand.
If you've ever gone carpet shopping, oftentimes the carpet salesman will show you various grades of carpeting.
Right, right.
Okay. Well, if you consider the prostate biopsy specimen, you evaluate it based upon a set criteria of grades of abnormally appearing prostate cells, that is, prostate cancer cells, and you try to match the grade of cell that you have in front of you under the microscope with kind of a reference grade of cancer. And so it's, the more aggressive, the less normal appearing the cell,
right.
The higher the grade. And so in carpet shopping, higher grade carpeting is more expensive and more desirable, but it's just the opposite,
prostate
cancer, yeah.
1-800-552-8502. Call us tonight with your question on prostate health, prostate cancer. We do have Cass from Hugh Springs, Texas, who's been holding there. Thanks for being so patient. What's your question tonight?
Kind of got a two-part question. I'm 32 years old. I think I'm a little ways off before I need to start thinking about an exam. But what age do I need to start getting an exam? And between now and then, should I look for any warning signs? Like, what would tell me I have a prostate problem? And I'll just hang up and listen.
All right. Thank you.
That's a great question. At age 32, you're not really at risk for prostate cancer today. If you were to have a father or brother that was diagnosed with prostate cancer, you'd really need to start your screening at age 40. There may be a push in the next few years to start earlier than that, but I think 40 is a great place to really be thinking about it. And again, the screening is both the rectal exam and the PSA test. As far as prostate disease, there are lots of prostate diseases. We talk about enlarged prostate, difficulty urinating, things like that. From prostate cancer specifically, you know, there are not a lot of symptoms unless you have very significant advanced disease. Advanced disease may give you problems like bone pain, back pain. It could give you an inability to urinate, things like that. But those are very uncommon. Again, most men now are being screened, so we're finding the disease when it's more localized. It's not everybody, but that's most men.
Dr. Smith, do you tend to screen African Americans at a younger age?
Yeah, I would recommend it.
Yeah, so typically 35 for an African American, per se, particularly if they have a family history?
I don't know that I would recommend 35 yet. Again, I think that the trends are starting to move earlier and earlier in terms of the American Urologic Association recommendations. The last I saw, I think, was that they were recommending 45 for everyone and still 40, I think, for African-Americans and for folks with family history.
So African-Americans have a tendency to get the disease earlier?
Yeah, they do. And we don't really know why. There were some theories relative to testosterone production and things like that, but really nothing's panned out. Again, traditionally, we kind of think of African-Americans as being at higher risk for developing the disease and higher risk for developing a more aggressive disease. And that raises a lot of questions, socioeconomic questions. And there's a lot of literature out there about that.
Okay, we have Steve right now who's calling from Jackson, Mississippi. Steve, thank you so much for joining us tonight on Health Matters. What's your question?
Yes, I'm 45 and had a PSA test of, I think it was a little bit over 4, and also had the rectal exam that he said was very normal. Went to a urologist, and he also said it was normal and suggested that I just take antibiotics for about a month, and he didn't seem concerned at all. He thought, you know, from his rectal test that he didn't see any problem. My question is, what other things would cause a high PSA, and what should be the level of concern?
Yeah, typically infection can cause an elevated PSA. It's probably one of the most common. And so prostate infections may not be something that we can see in a urinalysis or even in a urine culture, but can exist nonetheless. And it may not be always caused by a bacteria that we can culture or see. The treatment for this infection is usually antibiotics, and generally it requires up to a month, sometimes even longer, to clear these infections. And some men are just more prone to them, and some men are treated effectively for them, and then the prostate infection can come back. Certainly, if you had symptoms of a prostate infection, prostatitis is what we typically call it, that would be associated with an elevated PSA. But oftentimes, even without symptoms, you can have a subclinical prostatitis. Sometimes on digital rectal examination, you can feel this some suggestion of infection. But even empiric treatment with antibiotics can often be helpful. A repeat PSA then after a course of antibiotics is often lower, and then that establishes the baseline, and you follow it from there.
All right, 1-800-552-8502, the number to call to be on Health Matters this evening with your question. And I hope if you do have a question that you will indeed call in. We have Larry from Ida, Louisiana, who's holding right now. Larry, what's your question?
I just wanted to know, I'm a 55-year-old male. I'm a former ranch cowboy. I rode a lot of horses for a living. I'm just wanting to know if that causes a lot of problems with your prostate. That's the only question I had. I appreciate it.
All right, thanks for calling.
I don't know of any association necessarily between riding horses and prostate problems. I don't think it will affect you as far as your risk of prostate cancer per se. There is some concern about men who do bicycling and the risk of urethral issues, bladder outlet obstruction, urethral stricture, and impotence. So I'm not going to ask you if you're impotent, but that's something that could certainly be a concern because you place pressure on the nerves and the vasculature that control erections and allow for erections. But if you're having any issues with a slow urinary stream, waking up at night often to go to the bathroom, that feeling of urgency, meaning you got to go now or you're going to wet yourself, anything like that, those can certainly be symptoms associated with an enlarged prostate.
Well, I guess that sort of relates to, of course, the lifestyle question that I asked earlier. Of course, diet is one aspect of it. Sounds like certain physical activities might not cause anything, but is there anything else aside from diet that might relate to causing problems?
Well, we mentioned family history, and that's not really something that you can modify.
Sure.
And then, of course, the environmental exposures. The Agent Orange being one, but pesticides and some other industrial chemicals have been implicated. There was some thought for a while that perhaps supplementing with selenium and vitamin E and lycopene from tomatoes might reduce your risk, and I think there's been conflicting data on that. There are some medications that you can take that apparently may reduce your risk of developing prostate cancer, though paradoxically the people who take those medications and do develop prostate cancer tend to develop a more aggressive form. So that's not widely practiced, I don't believe. So for the most part, like many other cancers, healthy diet and exercise, I think, is generally recommended to reduce your risk.
Sure.
I agree, but the urologist that's really promoting the idea of reducing the risk of prostate cancer with finasteride is extremely well respected, and his arguments are very strong. And I think that although I'm not 100% convinced that I want to place my patients on it as a prophylactic, so to speak, for prostate cancer, I would be surprised if that doesn't become more of a trend over the short and long term.
All right. So you mentioned finasteride. Now, this is something that I'm not familiar with, and maybe many listeners aren't. So want to give a little detail about exactly what this is, this treatment?
It's Proscar. It's... It's a medication that we give largely to shrink the prostate. Mm-hmm. So the idea is a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor. The idea is that it shrinks the prostate and over many months will give men an improved ability to urinate. So it's basically an enlarged prostate medication.
Okay.
Simple way to think about it. It was originally designed with the idea that it would be an anti-prostate cancer medication. So it was. I think it was originally designed for that, with that in mind. Didn't really pan out. So now it's found a niche with BPH treatment, and it's always they're always looking for new ways to reduce risk of diseases. This has come up as a thought and an idea, and Dr. Ian Thompson has some very good data to show that it does reduce the risk, but in the men that have developed prostate cancer on the studies, these are many thousands of men in the studies, they've had a higher Gleason score when they've been diagnosed.
Okay.
So they tend to have a more advanced
disease.
That's
what Dr. Katz was just mentioning.
Exactly. Right. So the question is, are we really selecting out a higher grade disease, a more aggressive disease, or are we simply not diagnosing men with a lower grade disease, which would be good?
Yeah, but the thing that makes it controversial is that if you have a disease that we started off the hour talking about whether or not we should be screening people for this disease, mm-hmm. and then there's a question is whether we should be treating them for the disease, and now you're talking about putting men on medication for decades to prevent this disease, and now what you've done is you've transferred all this cost and potential side effects and interactions with medication, on the back end, and or should I should say the front end. And so from a public policy standpoint, it may not make a whole lot of sense.
Right.
And so that's what makes this controversial. I mean, the same controversy occurred with cholesterol lowering, and now it's a mega business, and there's people who argue whether or not that's truly beneficial. I'm not here to talk about cardiovascular disease, but I think particularly with prostate cancer, it's a much more difficult argument to make to treat men for decades with a medication to help reduce a risk of a condition that we may not necessarily be needing to treat. So, you know, I think it's beyond the scope of our discussion here this evening, but it is an interesting topic.
Except that, again, if you treat men and you can eliminate the men from diagnosing, if you can eliminate the men from requiring a biopsy that would do well with their prostate cancer anyway, that's where the benefit is. So in that 2/3 or 90% or whatever number you want to use of overtreated men, if you can reduce that number and simply select out the men with a more significant disease, then that's a positive benefit, and there's cost benefit there also.
So you're saying to take those men who are that you think have prostate cancer, and rather than biopsying them, put them on Proscar?
No. I'm saying what you're essentially doing is you're trying to reduce the number of men that you would biopsy in the first place. So by putting them on the Proscar, you are, in essence, selecting out the men for a biopsy later that will have a higher grade disease and a disease that really requires treatment. So in those men that are, you know, Gleason 5, Gleason 6, where you would kind of look at them and say, gosh, we have to treat this because it's cancer, you're not going to diagnose those men because you're not going to have progression of their cancer to a point where they would be diagnosed in the first place.
Yeah, but I still think that the cost of putting half the population in the United States or, you know, above a certain age would be more expensive and perhaps have caused more trouble than biopsying a selected group of men. I think perhaps if we improve our screening tools with respect to the PSA or even some other tests that have not yet been developed, that may be a cheaper way to go than to keep men on a medication.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, you're both approaching this from two different directions, and it's an interesting conversation, but you brought up something here that I've been wondering about. What are the emerging technologies in screening? Is there anything that's on the horizon or something that's been talked about that you might be aware of that's somewhere down the pipe?
Well, the gentleman caller who we heard from earlier seems to have some information about a urine test that may be available in Europe, PC3?
Yeah, it's essentially a urine test that I think is available in Europe right now. It's had some literature in the European Journal of Urology, but we've not embraced that technology here in the United States yet. I can't tell you why exactly, but we just haven't done it. Other than that, when I was in my training, 10, 15 years ago, we were 5 years away from having a vaccine for prostate cancer. We're not there yet. So, I think there's a lot of genetic issues that are a lot of people looking at these things, trying to come up with a better mousetrap, trying to come up with a better way to screen and diagnose and really to treat. But it takes time. Again, this is a very slow-growing tumor, so you're not talking about, you know, being able to necessarily come in with an idea, implement it, and then have an answer in 2 or 3 years. I think that a lot of these processes take, you know, literally decades to really figure out, are we going to have a benefit or not?
Sure. I have a question here from a listener who didn't want to go on the air, but before I give that to you, I do want to remind you that you can call in to tonight's Health Matters. Our number is 1-800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And again, I'm with radiation oncologist Dr. Sanford Katz, urologist Dr. Lauren Smith, and of course we are discussing prostate health and prostate cancer in particular. So by all means, call in. So this question was, and when I saw this, maybe things you said that most men are diagnosed somewhere with a Gleason score of 6. So I'm not sure exactly what this means, but this patient was recently diagnosed with a Gleason grade of 9. I would like to know if this would possibly be containable through radiation and hormone therapy, or if these would be, or if this would just cause more potential for the spread.
Yeah, you know, Gleason's. First of all, I want to first make the statement that that, you know, we're really not able to give specific recommendations about any particular individual's a condition, and this is a program for just general information. But and with that said, in general, the higher the Gleason score, the higher the PSA, the more advanced the cancer is on finger examination, on the digital rectal examination, the less likely the cancer is to be contained within the prostate gland. Now, when we're talking about treatment for prostate cancer, we first have to determine whether the cancer is localized to the prostate, whether it's perhaps beyond the prostate but in the region of the prostate in the pelvis, or if it is more disseminated, if it's out in the bones or in other parts of the body. And the treatment really depends upon where the cancer is. When you're talking about very high PSAs or very high Gleason scores, or even very high, very large nodules, you know, a person is at risk for having disease that that perhaps is systemic. And so, you know, a thorough evaluation may identify that, and in that situation, generally the treatment is systemic in nature, like hormone therapy.
Right.
However, when the cancer appears more localized, and it is a Gleason's 9 or a high PSA, it is less likely for surgery to be able to remove it in its entirety, and generally we like to treat with radiation and hormone therapy in those situations. Now, we can also do radiation in earlier stage disease in lower grade Gleason scores and lower PSAs. But there is, you know, a question, and in many cases, there are lots of answers to what is the best way to treat the prostate cancer. And so that answer may be different for different people. So in some cases, you may have the option of surgery or radiation or implants. But generally, when you have a more advanced cancer, we usually treat them with radiation and hormone therapy, and surgery is usually not done. Now, there are exceptions to that rule. Sometimes we may do surgery, radiation, and hormones, but it's usually individualized.
Okay. 1-800-552-8502, the number to call, so you can participate in tonight's Health Matters. And I will mention, and also for the benefit of our doctors in here, because the lights are flashing on and off, and that obviously there's the possibility of the power going out. We have backup generators in here, so we'll stay on the air. But I notice we've lost communication with the phone bank. But that being the case, I know we have someone that's waiting on the phone right now, and this is Carrie from Shreveport. Good evening to you. Why don't you go ahead with your question?
Yes, I was just wondering if there was any correlation between the individuals who develop prostate cancer later in their, you know, after they're 40 or so. Is there any relation to their lack of sexual activity, maybe in their through their life or even in their older years, that may develop cause that disease to develop?
I don't know of a relationship between a lack of sexual activity and prostate cancer, but I'm a big advocate of sexual activity. So,
yeah, I think there was a time when people thought that if you did not ejaculate frequently enough, that this would put you at greater risk for developing prostate cancer. Now, I don't know that that's necessarily true, but I think as long as it is controversial and the jury's still out, better err on the side of caution.
There you go. 1-800-552-8502. Now, that when I was Googling about information about that, actually, I did see a discussion related to that specifically, and it was that the myth is that sexual activity in the long term actually caused or had a tendency to cause prostate cancer, but that they have since found, or that there at least are some studies related to it that prove the opposite or show the opposite. Whether those are legitimate studies or not, I don't know.
Yeah, I think men have been trying to convince their wives and girlfriends for many years that it's in their best interest.
1-800-552-8502. Join us tonight on Health Matters. We do have another caller right now. I don't have a name, but if you just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Yes, my name is Lee. I'm from Shreveport, Louisiana.
Wonderful. And what's your question this evening?
My question is this. My father was diagnosed with prostate cancer 5 years ago. He was not a candidate for surgery. He was treated with radiation. The cancer has recurred, and his urologist and oncologist have been unable to determine whether or not the cancer is metastasized. But the oncologist told me that he would treat it the same way in either event, and I've read about other markers that can be used to tell if it has metastasized, and they poo-pooed that idea.
Any thoughts?
Yeah. If there is any other way to diagnose whether it has metastasized more definitively than they have.
Okay. So if a person has treatment for their prostate cancer and it recurs, generally the way it's picked up is with a rising PSA. So the PSA would go to an undetectable level or a low level and stay there, and then at some point, let's say it started to rise, that would be indicative of a recurrence. Now, the question then becomes, is that cancer localized where it was in the prostate initially, or has it spread to other parts of the body? Well, it may not be an important question to have answered, and the reason is that if the cancer is localized or if it's in the bones, the treatment may otherwise be the same, and that is with hormonal therapy. So whether you utilize either surgical castration or chemicals, hormone therapy, that is to block testosterone levels in the body, the treatment is the same. So as much as one may want to know whether the cancer is in other parts of the body, it's not necessarily always easy to tell. We would do a bone scan, looking at the bones for evidence of damage related to prostate cancer spread. But sometimes those bone scans are normal, meaning not necessarily that there's no cancer in them, but rather that there's no damage done to the bones that we can detect from the prostate cancer as of yet. So you may find yourself in a situation where there is a trace of prostate cancer, that is the PSA is elevated, you know it's there, you don't know exactly where it is, but the treatment would otherwise be the same, and that is with hormone therapy.
You brought up one issue there that did have me wondering, the reoccurrence of cancer once it's been treated. How frequently does that happen, and is that much of a concern?
Yeah, fortunately, it's not a frequent occurrence. In my own practice, it's fortunately not a frequent occurrence, but it does occur, and fortunately, there are treatment options most of the time after a recurrence, and so often the option is hormonal therapy. Sometimes it can be radiation therapy. But it's, we do a pretty good job of treating prostate cancers, particularly when they're caught early, and that's the argument for the PSA. So when the prostate cancer is caught early, low PSA, generally the outcome is very favorable, and the recurrence rates are low.
1-800-552-8502, the number to call to be a part of tonight's Health Matters. Just about 12 minutes or so left in this program this evening, so if you want to get your question in, by all means give that call, 800-552-8502. We do have someone holding now. Go ahead with your question this evening.
Actually, I'm 66. I have a very low PSA count, but I'm considering the possibility of taking testosterone. I can read a lot about the side effects, none of which I like, but, they're better than possibly other options. I may do it anyway, but I really wondered what the potential effect on what y'all are talking about, the cancer and future prostate problems and other problems if I start taking that stuff. Anyway, I'll hang up now and listen to what you have to say about it.
All right, thank you. What about testosterone?
I think testosterone replacement therapy is it's kind of an in vogue idea right now. I won't say that it's necessarily good or bad. In my practice, I tend to treat patients who have low levels and have symptoms. So without knowing specifically what kind of symptoms are involved, as far as feeling weak, tired, lack of erections, lack of sex drive, things like that, and what the actual testosterone level is, I can't say whether testosterone treatment is a good idea or not. Relating to prostate cancer is interesting. traditionally, we have thought of prostate cancer as being hormonally driven, which it is. We've always thought or often thought that elevated testosterone levels predisposed men to higher rates or higher risk of developing prostate cancer. I think that idea is going to change, and I don't fully understand the science behind it, but at the American Urologic Association meeting this past spring in Chicago, there was a very interesting session relating to androgen replacement therapy in men and how it relates to prostate cancer. And essentially what happened is there's this guru, there's an androgen guru, who looked at replacing testosterone in men who were at risk for developing prostate cancer. And what he did is he took a subset of men as controls and biopsied them. And then he biopsied men who were being given testosterone replacement therapy. And what he found is that there was no difference in the cancer detection rate between the two groups. So essentially what he found is that giving men testosterone did not increase the risk of developing prostate cancer, which really goes against what our you know, thought process has been for a long time. So I think what we're going to find over the next few years is that we're going to have to better define the role of testosterone in prostate cancer. His theory right now is that actually low levels of testosterone may predispose men to a higher risk of prostate cancer. So it's, I think that's very much a work in progress. And again, I can't say that it's a good idea or a bad idea, but if a man has symptoms and has low testosterone level, I think it's a very reasonable thing to do based on today's medical practice.
All right, about 8 minutes or so left in Health Matters this evening. If you'd like to give us a call, 800-552-8502. I'm joined by radiation oncologist Dr. Sanford Katz and urologist Dr. Lauren Smith, and we're discussing prostate cancer and prostate health. Question that I have, because you've touched on at different points in, you know, if someone has been diagnosed with it, some of the treatments, but what generally, if someone comes to you and they're diagnosed, let's say with the early stages of prostate cancer, what's going to happen? What should they expect to be a treatment?
Yeah, well, in an ideal situation, a person who is diagnosed with early stage prostate cancer should be counseled as to all their treatment options. I mean, in addition to the observation, watchful waiting option that we discussed earlier, mm-hmm. You know, generally the accepted forms of treatment are either surgery or radiation in various forms. There are various forms of surgery. There are various forms of radiation. Some are appropriate in some situations. Some are appropriate in others. So generally what I think and what the National Cancer Institute recommends is that a person diagnosed with prostate cancer should be seen by a urologist who treats the disease, and should also be seen by a radiation oncologist who treats the disease. And In that situation, they're able to get the perspective of the experts in their field, and they're able to get an unbiased opinion of each of the treatments. They're able to get their questions answered by the most knowledgeable people with respect to the two treatments, and then they can make a decision. Now, it's generally should be a decision of the patient. If they have multiple treatment options available to them, and they're able to weigh the benefits and advantages and side effects with each of the treatment options, they're in the best position to tailor their decision to meet their own particular lifestyle and priorities. Some of the treatments have sexual side effects, some of them have urologic side effects, some of them have rectal side effects. And so depending on a particular patient's situation, one side effect may be less acceptable than another. However, that also is difficult because we're so accustomed to going to a doctor and asking the doctor, okay, doc, I have this problem. What should I do? How should we treat this? And sometimes it's a little disconcerting to patients when you present them with various treatment options and then put it back to them to decide. However, I think it's important that patients be informed of all their treatment options and be able to make a decision for themselves.
And I agree. When I have patients that I diagnose with prostate cancer, I think there are two things that I think are very important. Number one is that when they come in for a discussion, we're going to sit down for an hour or longer and really kind of look at their baggage, look at the things that are happening in their lives that will allow them to make a good decision. Because this is, in many cases, it's a couple's problem. The man's got the cancer, but this is going to affect his family also. So sure. it's a much broader reaching impact than what you kind of think of. So I think it's important to have those family members present in during the discussion. The other thing that comes up, again, I mentioned baggage. I talk about it with them in terms of curative versus controlling therapies. We don't necessarily want to cure all of these cancers. It sounds crazy, but if you've got a 75 or an 80-year-old man who you think is going to have other more significant medical problems where the prostate cancer is not going to kill him, sometimes the answer is to control it. If I've got a 50-year-old gentleman who's got prostate cancer that's maybe high grade or high volume, or has significant heart disease, and he's had 3 heart attacks already in the past year, he's going to die because of his heart disease. Mm-hmm. So that might be someone who you control or offer watchful waiting to. So there's a lot that goes into this beyond just the book answer of what's correct for a given Gleason score, a given PSA at a given age.
Okay. We have one more caller this evening. This will probably be our last caller for the program. This is Forshee calling from Toledo Bend. Thank you so much for waiting. What's your question this evening?
Well, I was just going to ask you just exactly how much y'all did tell him about it. I got caught you on the radio coming in, and I wanted to tell you about my business with prostate cancer. And it is a cancer that can be stopped in 2 different ways. But I wanted to do it one way, and that was taking female hormones, and female hormones killed the cancer. And then through your balls, and there is the stuff that comes out of your balls, like crop, it feeds the cancer.
Okay, so it sounds like a treatment with female hormones?
What he's talking about is hormonal therapy or hormonal ablation. And again, when I talk to patients about it, the way I describe it is, you know, if you think about the prostate and testosterone, which is produced in the testicles, about 95% of it is produced in the testicles, that's going to be the fuel for the fire. So if the prostate cancer is the fire, the testosterone is what we've traditionally thought is fueling that growth or fueling that fire. So if we can give medications that reduce the testosterone level, we know that the PSA level goes down. In theory, what it does is it controls the cancer. So it doesn't cure the cancer, but it controls it. But it has side effects on top, which Dr. Katz alluded to earlier, as far as osteopenia, brittle bones, things like that. So there are hot flashes. I mean, you know, it's kind of like men are going through menopause with their hot flashes. So it can be a miserable treatment, but a very effective treatment.
And sometimes that treatment is actually easier to tolerate than, let's say, mm-hmm. a surgery or a course of radiation, particularly if somebody is older or infirm or has multiple medical problems. But you are concerned that the prostate cancer is going to become a problem during the remainder of that person's life.
Right.
So that is sometimes utilized, and it's also the same treatment that is utilized in the event of a recurrence, particularly one that is systemic in nature or has metastasized.
Right. Okay. Well, that makes sense. We have about a minute or so, maybe 2 minutes here. If you want to just touch briefly, preventive lifestyle, whatever, what people should do to guys to make sure that we avoid it if possible, and if in which case, what should we look for, and what should be the warning signs that we should go ahead and seek help?
Yeah, I think again, there are really no warning signs, unfortunately. So I think that men need to be aware of it. They need to actively pursue screening. The idea free screening clinics, things like that. Unfortunately, in my experience, it's been the same men coming every 6 months or every year to get that screening done. So
sure.
I'm not sure that we touch the men that need to be touched as far as getting out in the community and getting them in for screening. As far as preventive measures, again, I won't touch on the finasteride, although I guess I did. Eating healthy, good healthy living, lifestyle, reduce obesity, things like that are all probably good, but they're good in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think you need to also know your PSA. PSA that is normal and you go to one doctor and it's normal, you go to another doctor, or let's say you go to a free screening and it's normal for 3 years, but each time that PSA is significantly higher but still within the normal range. It's important for a man to know their own PSA and what it's been and to keep those records themselves, particularly if they're going to be switching physicians or if they're going to be getting screenings at free screenings and free clinics.
All right. Well, Dr. Sanford Katz and Dr. Lauren Smith, I want to thank you both for joining us tonight on Health Matters.
Thanks for having us.
Health Matters is produced for informational purposes only. As always, if you have a specific medical question, we recommend that you contact your own health care provider. The producer of Health Matters is Renee Moran. Assisting tonight was Wally Derleth and Henry Edwards. I'm your host, Kermit Poling. Thanks for being with us this evening. Fresh Air is coming up next. This is member-supported Red River Radio, a public radio service of LSUS. You're tuned to KDAQ, Shreveport, Bossier City, KLSA, Alexandria, Pineville, KBSA, El Dorado, and KLDN Lufkin Nacogdoches, broadcasting also on translator K214CE Grambling. Thanks for joining us this evening. Good evening.